Hi, I'm Rabbi Mary Zamor, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And I say a huge mazel tov to the team on starting your third year of swimming in the Sea of Torah.
Hey, Amanda.
Yes, Gabe.
Where are you?
In life? Physically? Spiritually? Emotionally?
No, like physically. Like, where are you right now?
I'm in my apartment. Actually, I'm in our apartment.
Leave! Go forth from your home and go to this other random place that you don't know where it is, and I'm only gonna tell you where it is later.
Like placement?
Ooh, okay. That was a little too real. Alright, so you're going through this placement process, and that seems really scary and difficult. It's this whole journey of leaving a thing you knew and were mildly comfortable, and now you're going into the unknown.
For a rabbinic job, maybe.
Yeah, and that's really exciting, but also gotta be kind of scary.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different elements to look at. Where I want to live, who the best, like, people are to learn from, you know, what the job requirements might be, even how much I might get paid.
You know, I think we might have a guest who knows a little bit more about this kind of thing than I do.
Wait, you're saying there might be somebody who can speak to this week's Torah portion and speak to how people might figure out equal pay for the same type of rabbinic position?
I'm saying exactly that.
That's exciting. Do you think they might be able to help me out?
Let's find out.
Cool. Let's go. Hard to believe it, but this is our third time doing Lech Lecha, and we couldn't be more excited to start on this journey yet again with you. We know that we started our third season, but what many people might not realize is we didn't actually start with Bereishit. You know, we didn't start at the beginning when we launched this podcast on October 29th, 2020. We started with Lech Lecha. We started because we had a desire to get out the vote and make some changes, and we really wanted to try to have a powerful launch. And we did, and it's been an amazing ride and an incredible journey with all of you as we've been able to just be heard in almost every single state in the country and over 40 countries. And it's been incredible and amazing, and there's still so much work to do and so much Torah to explore and some things that might make you just go, what's that you say that, you know, the Torah always says the same thing? Well, maybe, but maybe not. It kind of depends who you are when you come to it. And also, what's going on in the world that might influence the way that you read it. So today, we're really excited because we have a special guest who's going to help us look at Lech Lecha through a very different lens than we may have looked at the last two times. Rabbi Mary L. Zamor is the Executive Director of the Women's Rabbinic Network, a partner organization of the Reform Movement. For over 40 years, WRN has worked to narrow the wage gap, create safer, respectful Jewish communities, and promote equity, while also supporting and advocating for Reform women and non-binary gender-fluid rabbis. At WRN, Rabbi Zamor co-leads the Reform Pay Equity Initiative and founded WRN's Clergy, Safe Employees, and Employers program, creating respectful and harassment-free Jewish communities for all. Rabbi Zamor has been named a Teruah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, Rabbinic Human Rights Hero in 2022. She is in the 2022 cohort of JWI's Jewish Communal Women's Leadership Project, as well as a fellow with Association for Public Religion and Intellectual Life at Auburn Seminary, NYC, studying in the Oppressions and Repair Colloquium. She is the editor of The Sacred Exchange, Creating a Jewish Money Ethic, and The Sacred Table, Creating a Jewish Food Ethic, designated a finalist by the National Jewish Book Awards. Ordained by Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York, which is, you know, where I'm going to be ordained, hopefully, in the near future, in 1997, Rabbi Zamor graduated from Columbia College. She proudly served congregations in central New Jersey for 18 years. That's a high. That's a whole lifetime of congregational life before joining WRN. Rabbi Zamor, we are so excited to welcome you to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I am thrilled to be here.
We are thrilled to have you here, and we're really excited to get to talk with you, especially about some of the dicier parts of this portion that people might not have paid attention to in the past. Having said that, anytime I feel like I'm facing some sort of real challenge, be it personal, social, maybe even financial, I always love to get the support and advice of my favorite co-host with the co-most. What's going on, Gabe Snyder? How's it going today?
It's all good. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm good, but can I borrow $5?
I mean, I guess. Is everything, you know, okay?
Yeah, everything's fine. I just wanted to make a point that you are always willing to share equitably in this apartment. Well, we don't have Idan here with us today. We do want to send him some love and just say hello, and we hope to have you back soon. Everybody's schedule is a little tight, even post-Hagim, and, you know, we're excited to all be together the next time we're able to. We hope everybody's having an incredible time, and we're so excited to get started with one of our favorite parshas, that is Lech Lecha. So, what are you waiting for? Let's go. Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I just realized something just now.
Okay, what is it?
Okay, so I get that you are smart and you're funny and you're brave, right?
I try to be all of those things, yes.
But I just realized, like, right this second, how good looking you are.
Well, thank you. Wow, that's very nice of you. Wait, you just realized?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. We've been spending all this time together, and I just, like, I was looking at the computer, and I just realized how good looking you are. Isn't that kind of, like, it's a little crazy, right?
I mean, yeah, I guess so. Where is this going?
Well, so I just, you know, I know that when we're planning a journey or an adventure that people might be a little nicer to me just because I'm with you and you're so good looking.
Okay, I'm not entirely sure I follow, but go on.
Well, so isn't that part of the story this week?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I guess so. There's this whole episode with Avram and Sarai, and they're in Egypt, and there's this lie about who she is and about who he...
Wait a minute. Hold on. Aren't you getting a little ahead of yourself? Shouldn't we start at the beginning?
I guess so. So there's this guy named Avram who lives with his wife Sarai and his nephew Lot in Haran. They're doing fine, living in a place that they've been in their whole lives, but then God tells Avram to move. Where to? God will let you know. So Avram and Sarai and Lot and all their stuff set out for a new land with the promise of blessings and prosperity and a legacy. They're making their way south, building a couple altars along the way when a famine hits, so they decide to go to Egypt because apparently there's food there. I wonder if that will happen again. But Avram tells Sarai to lie and say that she's his sister so the Egyptians won't kill him and take her as one of their wives. Sure enough, when they got to Egypt, the Egyptians noticed how beautiful she was and they brought her to Pharaoh, giving Avram sheep and cattle and donkeys and slaves and camels in return. Now, God didn't like that Pharaoh took Sarai, so God struck the whole house of Pharaoh with a plague. Pharaoh figured that Avram had lied to him and had them driven out of Egypt with all of their stuff, including the new stuff they got from Egypt. So they went back up through the desert with all of their stuff and praised God. Now, between Lot and Avram and Sarai and a whole bunch of stuff, this land wasn't going to be big enough for all of them. So they make a deal that Lot will go east as far as Sodom, a place that will be important later, and Avram and Sarai will dwell in Hebron. Now, God says to Avram, look to the north and the south and the east and the west. I'm giving all of this land to your descendants. They'll be like the dust of the earth. Apparently, in this context, being like dust is a good thing. Oh, by the way, there was a big war. Don't worry about it. The important part is that Lot was taken captive and Avram went out and rescued him. Also, there's this guy named Melchizedek, who's the king of Salem and also a priest of God, and he blesses Avram, which is cool, I guess. The king of Sodom also tried to give Avram a bunch of stuff, but Avram was like, nah, I'm good, which made God pretty happy, so God sent Avram a vision and told him he will receive a great reward. But really, all Avram wants is a kid. So God has Avram look at the stars and says, can you count these stars? Yeah, totally. Really? How many are there? Okay, so Avram can't count the stars, and that's kind of the point. Avram's descendants are going to be as unfathomably numerous as the stars in the sky. So God has Avram make a sacrifice of a 3-year-old calf, a 3-year-old goat, a 3-year-old ram, and a young turtle dove. Avram bisects the animals, chases away some vultures, and falls asleep when he suddenly falls into a deep and dark dread. God tells Avram of a terrible future. Avram's descendants will be strangers in a strange land and be subjected to slavery for 400 years. But good news, God will save them. Also, in the darkness, Avram sees a smoking oven and a fiery torch pass between the pieces of the sacrifice. I don't really know what that means, but moving on. God makes a covenant with Avram, promising the land from the Nile to the Euphrates. Cool. So Sarai still doesn't have any kids, and she's starting to think that she might just never be able to get pregnant, so she sends her slave Hagar to bear Avram's child instead. Once Hagar is pregnant, though, Sarai changes her mind and treats her badly. Hagar runs away, but an angel tells her to go back, and her son Ishmael will also be a great and mighty nation. But beware, his descendants will fight with Avram's other descendants. Not great. So Hagar names God El-Roi, which means God sees me. Cool. So Ishmael is born when Avram is 86. 13 years pass, and God renames Avram Avraham, or Abraham, for languages that like that better for some reason, and also renames Sarai Sarah. Also, God reiterates the covenant of the land and the descendants. God also proclaims that Sarah will bear a son, which made Abraham laugh because he's almost 100 and Sarah is 90. God insisted that it would in fact come to pass. Finally, Abraham circumcises himself and also the 13-year-old Ishmael and also all of the slaves. Sounds like a fun activity for everyone involved. And that's Parashat Lech Lecha.
Well, Gabe, you do the best summaries, and I love the fact that even now in your third year, they're all different, even though it's the same text. So awesome.
Thank you. You know, I try to reread them every year, and as Amanda said, you know, you read something different every time you read it. Every time you look at it, something new pops out. There's something new that jumps out as important or new details. You got to keep turning it.
That is the beauty of Torah.
You know, it's been a really incredible opportunity to speak to many different leaders, but one of the things that we haven't been able to do necessarily is always speak with groups that advocate for not only themselves, but also for others. And I saw, and I know we talked a little bit about in your bio, at the Women's Reform Network, that you support not only reform women, but also non-binary and gender fluid rabbis and making sure that people are all seen. And so I'm wondering, could you tell us a little bit more about the Women's Rabbinic Network and how it, you know, kind of helps fight for everybody and support everyone?
Absolutely. And I just want to clarify, we are the Women's Rabbinic Network. So we've been around for over 40 years, as you said before. And just this past spring, we voted to expand our membership definition to include gender fluid, non-binary rabbinical students and rabbis of the Reform Movement. But our mindset has always been starting with our lived experiences, supporting one another, but advocating in a way so that the changes, the interventions that we were advocating for would benefit all. So we don't just advocate for equal pay for one group or even just rabbis within that group, but for everybody who's employed within the Jewish community. And we try to make those materials as accessible and open as possible.
And as the executive director, the person who's helping kind of steer people towards that mission, you know, I know you spoke a little bit about your journey to get there, that you were in congregational life for 18 years before joining WRN. But what really, you know, inspired you to go in that direction, to take that journey?
My journey with WRN actually started in rabbinical school. And I have been an active member of WRN since rabbinical school at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. And in fact, in 2007 through 2009, I served as co-president with Rabbi Sue Levi Elwell as a lay leader. And it's only now in the 7+ year, I'm now in my 8th year, that I'm the professional, I'm the executive director.
So you've taken a really interesting journey in your career path, because you've touched a lot of different things. You've been in school, you've been in congregational life, you're now in organizational life, and yet there's been this through line. So I'm curious what that through line does for you on this journey, maybe what that through line, where you see it kind of manifest. I'm also curious though, because I'm just thinking about journeys, how difficult it must be to set out from one place that's relatively comfortable and move into something new, move into something different, whether that's moving into rabbinical school or into seminary, or moving out of seminary into congregational life or out of congregational life. I guess that's four different questions, but I'm going to let you take your pick as to where to go with it.
I think I'll focus on that through line because I didn't really answer Amanda's question completely about how I became engaged with WRN. I am a fourth generation Reformed Jew. My son is a fifth generation Reformed Jew. I grew up literally in the synagogue as my parents were very active lay people in the synagogue and very involved in college, went directly from college to HUC. And I really feel great gratitude for the values, the Jewish values that my Judaism has instilled in me, and specifically the way Reform Judaism has helped me understand how to live in the world and to still hold those values and live those values, and how to have beautiful ritual practices that sustain those values. And at the same time, as a younger adult, entering into seminary and interacting with the world, what I experienced as a woman was that the values I was being taught and had been raised on did not align with the way I and the people around me were being treated. And, you know, if you had asked me, for instance, in college, if you would ever find me in a single gendered at that time organization, I would be like, wait, no way. But WRN became a refuge and support for me because I needed it. There was just so much bias and misogyny and so many people trying to shove me into such a small confined box and not to see me as a true leader. And I was witnessing things around that I knew were wrong. And so that's how I ended up in WRN and as a lay leader in WRN and today as a professional leader in WRN.
So I love the work that you do because I think that it speaks to something that some people talk about but not enough people know about, which is that women or non-cis men, which means people who are not assigned male at birth and identify as male now, are still often paid less than their cis male counterparts. And also that sometimes it's a lot of women doing work behind the scenes that make things go as successfully as they can without getting any of the recognition for it, which is a little frustrating. And in this particular Torah portion, you know, we a lot of the time when we have like the little kid, you know, version of it, we have the Debbie Freeman, Lechi Lech, right? Like this idea of like, go to this place that I will show you. I'll make your name great. You should be a blessing. Which, just so everybody knows, that goes through verse 3 of the first chapter of this particular Torah portion. But I want to move us a little bit further down and to say that in this episode where I tease Gabe that he was so good looking, and I just realized it now. Don't worry, Gabe. I always know it. It's true. But that in this particular portion, you know, Abraham or Abram says to Sarai, look, like, I'm nervous because we're exposed, we're vulnerable, we're in this place, like, they might not be great. And he says in Genesis 12:13, you know, Imri na achoti at lema'an yitavli ba'avurich. Like, let it be that you say that you're my sister in order that it will go well for me. Yitavli, that it'll go better for me, ba'avurich, because of you. And what's really amazing in here is that, like, I think Sarai, and when she becomes Sarah, doesn't always get the recognition she deserves, because I gotta tell you, what ends up happening is, by verse 16, Le'Avraham hetiv ba'avura, right? That Abraham, in fact, was better because of her, and because of her sake. And what does that mean for him? Vayehilo son uvakar v'chamorim v'avadim v'shipfachot v'atonot u'gamalim. That he has sheep and ox and donkeys and servants and, you know, camels. That there's all these things that all of a sudden Abraham gets because of Sarai. And she just gets not a ton of recognition for it. And I feel like maybe this is a place where we should dig a little deeper, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it.
Wow, so much to dig in there. So I'm going to even push the envelope a little bit further to say it's not just that she's not getting credit, but he puts her in a position to be physically abused. And that's so disturbing. Now, I want to say, as a Jew, as a rabbi, I actually celebrate the fact that our sacred texts disturb us. They are not beautiful rainbows and flowers all the time. That we see things in our text that are very difficult and challenging. And I think that's a really good thing. And we shouldn't just gloss over them, but we should actually linger over them, recognize them, and even explore why does it feel uncomfortable. And we're just not even a week later from the fifth anniversary of Me Too. And we know how many women and people of other beautiful identities are constantly put at risk, whether it's physically or mentally, spiritually. And so to see these things happening in ancient times, in the foundational texts of our people, I think is a wonderful opportunity just to have really difficult conversations. I also want to point out a key word that he starts that out with a nice, nah, please. He's not telling her she has to do it, but you really wonder how much choice she had. It's an interesting conversation, and you're right. It all ends up for his benefit. And of course, our communal benefit.
You know, it's not the only time that Avram makes a request, and not the only time that Avram makes a request that could be seen as perhaps, if not directly abusive or hostile, at the very least, a bit off-putting. Not only does Avram say, Imri na, please say that you're my sister, later, after Avram and Sarai and Lot get back to the land, Avram says to Lot, nah, please separate from us. It almost seems to me that Avram is pushing people away at this point. And I'm curious about that, about this idea of pushing people away, of being hostile to people, doing bad things, but doing it with a please, doing it politely. How do you respond to that? How do you hold both of those things of like, yes, you're being polite, you're phrasing it as a question, but you're doing a bad thing?
I just want to point out an essential difference in those two sections. First of all, Lot is, of course, captured in war and then rescued, where Sarai is handed over, basically, to protect. And Avram decides to separate Lot from Lot and to divide land because the land isn't able to sustain everybody. And the shepherds and the workers are fighting over where the animals can graze. So the second na seems like more of a suggestion and a diplomatic way of trying to make peace and make sure everybody has what they need equitably. Where the first one, you can have some compassion for the text and say they're unlanded at this moment. They've lech lecha, right? They've gone out. They're alone. They're vulnerable. And Avram sees this danger ahead and is trying to come up with a solution. But again, I don't like the solution. Sorry, I just can't like it.
It seems to me that on a regular basis in Genesis that women, especially the female counterparts of our patriarch, but I would even argue, you know, Lot's wife doesn't do so well either, that women are constantly put as, yes, as property, which like was at that point in time, like a piece of just the reality of history, but that they're basically looked at as a pawn for their husband's success or a person who is just meant to be pregnant and that is what they are meant to be. And I struggle with that because I am a single 36-year-old woman. I have not been pregnant. I've not been married. I do believe that I have more to offer the world than to be, you know, the person that will help make another person's success. Like, you know, I'm trying to see how to get past the idea of being a pawn. And here, you know, I do like the idea of Sarai, like, bringing, you know, her family credit and making sure that everybody was okay. But the idea is she may not have been able to do that. Like, you know, and So I think one of the things that I'm thinking about in applying this particular portion to today's kind of difficulty in knowing how to stand up for ourselves and how to be present and how to be strong in that presence is, how might we be able to be like Sarai, or take some of Sarai's power and really implement it in a way that she just seemed like she was unable to do here?
Well, I think that when we look at our ancient texts, first of all, they hold up a remarkable mirror to our own modern times. So it is glaring to us the way that women are not being treated as equals, just as you so beautifully stated it. And maybe when we look at women and, again, people of other identities today, that we say, well, look how much better you have it today, right? Isn't everything equal? I mean, I can't tell you how many times over the years people have literally said to me, why do you do this work? Everything is equal. But the answer is, it's not actually equal. We're getting there, but there is still this huge gap in many ways. And maybe at this moment of holding up that mirror, we can say women are only valued for their fertility. Women are pitted against each other. Women are endangered and not given credit. Let's now look at our own times and our own society and even our own micro communities and say, where do we replicate these bad behaviors? Maybe not in these extremes, hopefully not, but how do we do that even in smaller ways? And therefore, we can learn from that. And I think the secondary thing we can do is really dive into, not necessarily right now on this podcast, but to lift up amazing commentaries, sometimes ancient, mostly modern, that amplify and explore the experiences of the people who have less of a voice in our tradition.
So speaking of both people who have less of a voice in our tradition and this idea of pitting those people who have less of a voice against each other, we have this moment later on in our narrative in chapter 16, where Sarai says, you know, I guess I'm not going to be able to have a kid, and I want to be able to have a kid. I want to build up this family. And so Sarai says to Avram, go have a child with my maidservant, with my slave. We can argue about there's a power differential there. There's certainly a class distinction. And Sarai says, Ulai ibane mimena, meaning maybe I will be built up through her. Not maybe you will be built up, not maybe you'll have a child, but maybe I, Sarai, will gain merit through her actions, through her literal labor. And so that's just an interesting thing for me in general, is that power dynamic. Is, you know, we've talked about Avram using Sarai as a pawn. Now it seems that Sarai is doing the same thing with Hagar. And later on, Sarai is going to change her mind and then get upset and treat Hagar badly again in a different way. So I'm curious how we react to and how we deal with that dynamic of when people with less power then turn around and are not so kind to people with even less power than them.
I think it brings a wonderful point for what it means to have true structural change. That usually we think that structural change means that the people with all the power have to change, and that because they are the one doing everything to everybody else. And they are certainly one of the linchpins, but the reality is that we all contribute to the communities and power structures in which we function. And even the people who are maybe in the middle of that power structure, I'm not saying the people at the bottom, but certainly the people in the middle, which is most of the people, actually can reflect and make important changes. One of the things that I think is important when we look at our modern circumstances and we look at even the work WN does in terms of gender, and, you know, it is important to recognize that we all replicate the bad behavior. Often I hear just this kind of trying to pin it on old white men, and it is actually all of us. And people will say with surprise that a woman somehow acted with misogyny against another woman or bias to another woman. And, you know, with a different power dynamic. And it's not surprising to me because we are born into the system. This is the water with it which we live and which we live and swim. And it's the patterns that we learn. And again, the Torah is a wonderful roadmap for us, both the mistakes, the foibles, and the good. And it's always mixed with the good. You know, it would be easy to look at all of this and go, eh, who cares? Let's just throw it aside because it's all corrupt. It's not perfect. It's not beautiful narratives. I think it's just the opposite. This is at the same time held up with amazing values. And therefore, we can see when they're not living up to those values. And it challenges us then to look at our own behaviors and our own time and think about how we can do better and think about how we can do better.
So I'm going to take us a little bit abroad, but I think that it works and it still ties in with Sarah and Hagar. But I'm going to say that a lot of the time when we're looking at Genesis, there's kind of this fantastical element to it that these are real people, but it seems really far away. And so it's a little bit like watching a movie. And I have to tell you that it may not be a movie, but Marvel does have a new TV show that's been out called She-Hulk Attorney at Law. And this is going to sound really silly, but She-Hulk Attorney at Law has been getting a lot of props because of one line that is said by the main character. So the main character, who's played by Tatiana Maslany, plays Jennifer Walters, who is the She-Hulk. And what she says in talking to Bruce Banner, who is the original Hulk in the Marvel franchise, they talk about this idea of anger, and he's confused about why she, like, you know, is better able to control her anger and not Hulk out as he does. And she literally says to him, "I'm great at controlling my anger. I do it all the time. When I'm catcalled in the street, when incompetent men explain my own area of expertise to me, I do it pretty much every day because if I don't, I will get called emotional or difficult or might just literally get murdered. So I'm an expert at controlling my anger because I do it infinitely more than you." And I gotta tell you, Sarah's got some anger in this particular parsha. And she gets hit for it by the people who read the story. But I think that it's possible that, like, she's gone through some trauma. And I think one of the things that I would say is she's told, you know, and the She-Hulk that is saying, like, "I've learned to control it because I'll be called emotional." We are constantly told that we cannot have necessarily honest, real emotional reactions or anger towards injustice in the workplace or towards issues in the world. And I think I'm bringing this to your attention because it is really fascinating to control or hold that anger and want to do something positive with it, but also realizing that for a while, like, there is a right for us to be angry in this moment and in this portion.
Absolutely. You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking of a text that my dear friend and Rabbi Rachel Sabbath Beit Halachmi has taught not only me, but many, many people about Yalta and the Talmud and a woman who expresses her anger. And there are other women who express anger too. But you do wonder, you know, if Sarai could have channeled some anger at the beginning of this narrative. Really, when we get to see her in more fullness and in some ways get to see her beauty, not of the outer, but maybe it would be nice to get more of a look on the inside. If when Avraham said, "Nah, please do this because I, for me, you know, for what I need," maybe, you know, if she had been in a time or a situation to be empowered enough to look at him and say, "Really? Really? Do you understand the implications, what you're asking me to do? Do you think I'm really going to do that?" If she could have had that Yalta voice instead and break something and really let it out to prove to him, you know, how dramatically opposed she would be at that moment. Wow, like how different these narratives may have played out, or, you know, who knows? But, you know, we're kind of stuck with the way they're recorded. And so when we look at them, we're looking at the breadth and depth of human experience and trying to just figure it out with them.
I'm really curious about this idea of, you know, we're kind of stuck with how we have things recorded. We would like to see things play out differently. We would love to see Sarai make different decisions. We would like to see people be empowered differently. One moment that always bugs me in this Torah portion in particular is this episode where Hagar runs away from Sarai. where Hagar, this is like the first time that Hagar has like any agency and makes her own decision, and she chooses to run away. And God, or a messenger of God, comes and says, no, go back. Go back and submit to her harsh treatment. Submit, just take it. And your offspring will be greatly increased. And this child that you're going to have, who is going to be male, Ishmael, is going to be a great nation. But you still have to go back. You still don't get any choice in this matter. Like, that so bugs me. But there is one caveat that I just love. I love it so much that Hagar gives God a name. Hagar says, clearly, I'm out here and God sees me. And Hagar names God El-Roi, God who sees me. And I didn't realize this, but it was later taught to me that this is the only time a human person ever gives God a name. That God is always naming God's self, or just like comes with a name. And here we are with perhaps the like least empowered person in this entire narrative naming God. That's crazy to me. I don't really have a question in there. I'm really just, how do you respond to that? How do you take this idea of we might feel powerless, and yet we can be in conversation with God and have a different relationship with that like level of divinity than anybody else?
So first of all, I'm just a little bit annoyed because I was looking forward to teaching that. Oh no, that's okay. It is one of my favorites. And I love the fact that you've lifted that up, because it's a very important teaching from this, that the least empowered person does the most empowered thing. So I think it's a message to those of us who, whether it's a specific situation or that we belong to a certain identity class that is less empowered, to know that actually we have more power than we think we do, whether that is as individuals or when we band together, and that we have to sometimes, unfortunately, work to find that power. Sometimes we have to demand that others hear our power. But we do have power, and often it is magnificent. And this is a wonderful example of that.
I think also one of the things that matters is, you know, I think much of the time, and one of the things that I actually really love about it, is that, yes, Hagar bears a son and, you know, has Ishmael and does give God a name. But the reason that she gives God the name she gives is because she actually is seen. Like, she feels like that this is somebody who has seen her. You know, this idea of actually being forward and present and not a pawn, like we talked about before, and not a player in someone else's story. But I think that that matters so much. And so I know that we've gotten a little bit afield in terms of the questions that we had. I'm curious about, as somebody who is really seen as the executive director of the Women's Rabbinic Network, what type of power you have in that role, and how you help others who are trying to figure out how to stand in their power and to be seen for who they are, and what advice you might have for them.
So first of all, it's not as easy as it looks. You know, claiming power is very difficult. And I really have the amazing privilege of being the voice of the WRN community and the face that people see when I discuss these issues and when we advocate for these issues. But there are over 600 members of the WRN behind me. We often talk about Moses and the holding his hands up. You'll come to that in a future, way future episode. I know you've done the last 2 years. But that idea of none of us can do it alone. And I am so blessed to have co-presidents and a board and volunteers and members who constantly step up, not only to hold me up, but to hold our mission up, most importantly. I think the hardest thing to do is to be an individual in your community and to look at your community on that very micro level and say, you're not treating me the right way, or you're doing wrong. I've seen something in our community that's wrong, or you haven't treated me the right way, or number of people the right way, or you've allowed it to happen, or you haven't recognized it. And that is the hardest, hardest thing to do, because at the end of the day, you're still in that community most likely. And I am just so awed by the bravery that so many have shown in the last couple of years to come forward and to say, you need to do better by me and by other people, whether it's historic or present wrongs. And it's not easy. I just want to be honest about that. But nothing is going to change unless we find that bravery and that we are honest and truthful about what has really happened and what is happening. And it's only in that context. But at the same time, we can find support with one another and find ways to do it in safe ways and to make sure it can be heard.
I really appreciate that, Vase. And I want to just touch on one thing that I find slightly humorous, but not really. I think that women often struggle in relationship to their male counterparts in terms of praise and punishment. Now, here's a really interesting thing. Sarah, Abraham is told that Sarah is going to give him a son, right? Abraham's told by God in Genesis 17, in this particular portion, that Sarah is going to give him a son. Now, here's the deal. People know what the son's name is, right? The son that Sarah gives Abraham is Isaac. And people talk about the fact, why was he named Isaac, Gabe? Go for it.
Because Sarah laughed. And Yitzhak is laughing.
Because Sarah laughed and Yitzhak is laughter. And God, in the next portion, right? Not in this portion of Vayera, when Sarah laughs, God kind of chastises Sarah. But here's a funny, sneaky insert, which is that in this portion, in Genesis 17, verse 17, God has just told Abraham that Sarah's going to give him a son. And what's really fascinating about this is that something interesting happens. Gabe, I don't know if you're on the verse. Are you on the verse? And what happens? Nothing. Abraham not only laughs, he goes, no, let it be Ishmael, right? And God goes, you know? And so I think it's an interesting thing that I love the fact that, like, you know, Sarah gets the credit for laughing, but they both laugh. They both laugh at this idea that it's going to happen, that their lives can be different from how they view it. And I will say that Sarah gets the punishment, but not the praise. And that's a hard place to be. And it's a weird message to put out there. And so I want to do slightly better with our messaging. And so, Rabbi Mary Zamor, if you had one message that you wanted people to hear, something that you wanted them to feel or know or do after hearing this episode, what would you want the people to hear from you? What message would you hope that they are walking away with, whether they're laughing or not?
Well, you're right that laughter is no laughing matter, and it is totally unequal. It is easy to think that the problems of inequality, whether it's a wage gap, whether it's the issues of harassment or toxic workplace culture, it happens in other people's communities, that somehow that we as Jews, especially as liberal Jews, would be immune to all of that. It is really, really important to not just ask, are people treated well in our community? Are they treated appropriately? Are they paid appropriately? Are they paid equally? But how do we know that? Because it's so easy just to say, yes, oh, everything's good and happy here. But the real probing question is, well, how do we know that's true? Have we given people the opportunity in a safe way to voice that they have not been treated appropriately, that they're not being paid equitably, that they have somehow been hurt by us, harmed by us, and really create that safety to be able to listen and therefore have accountability, have repair, and make change.
Welcome to perhaps the silliest segment of Drinking and Droshing Torah with a Twist, Midrashic Mixology, where we make a cocktail based on the weekly Torah portion. So this week, for Parashat Lech Lecha, for that moment where Abraham looks up and sees all those stars in the sky, we proudly present the Starry Sky Smoothie. For a promise of a future as bright as the stars in the sky, Avram and Sarai take a pretty ridiculous journey. So here's a smoothie to help them cool off from all that wandering. Start off with a star fruit. They happen to be in season right now, which is pretty serendipitous. Cut it in half, just like Abraham's sacrifice of the calf, goat, ram, and turtle dove. Set one half aside for garnish. Devein the other half by removing that tough rib that runs along each edge and throw the fruit into a blender with 1 cup of orange juice and 1/3 cup of orange liqueur like Cointreau or Grand Marnier for all those oranges that belong on Seder plates. Finally, 1/2 cup of white rum and a handful of ice cubes for Avraham's lie and their icy dismissal from Egypt. Blend those all up into a nice smoothie and pour into 4 equal glasses for yourself and 3 of your travel buddies. For a non-alcoholic starry sky smoothie, swap in water for the rum, cut the orange liqueur, and ramp up the orange juice to 1 1/3 cups. Garnish with a slice of your reserved star fruit and serve. May your drinks be as flavorful as all the stars in the heavens. L'chaim.
I have to tell you, I've never had star fruit. They seem like they're a lot of work because I don't think I ever realized that you could devein a fruit, but I'm learning and it's okay. And it sounds like you are a star for creating this drink.
Aw, thanks, Amanda.
Of course. Can you do the deveining thing?
I will devein all of your star fruit for you.
Amazing. I am thrilled to have you in my service. So it seems like Gabe and I are going to get to explore our grocery store for some new star fruits, which hopefully they'll have because, as Gabe said, they're in season. So for all of you who might be new to the star fruit, Shehekianu for all of us because I, too, will be new to the star fruit, but I'm excited about it. I am also excited, though a little bit sad, that we've hit our last section, our thank yous and closing cues. I do want to point out something that we didn't spend a ton of time talking about, but really is an important piece of Rabbi Zamor's work, which is this idea of being able to work for the Reform Pay Equity Initiative and this idea that everybody deserves equal pay. I know we spoke to it a little bit, but that it's on us really to ensure that that happens for not just women, but for everybody who's working, and not just rabbis, but for everyone who might be working in a Jewish community. And so Mary, Gabe, and Lech Lecha were taught, although it is through Rashi, who's a commentator, that the words Lech Lecha, the title of this week's Parsha, literally mean go for yourself, you know, to do something specifically for you. And so what is one step that you would tell people to take or do or go after for themselves when it comes to ensuring pay equity for everyone? Mary, we'll start with you.
It is really important to talk with colleagues and to speak honestly about your compensation packages, to use the data that the different professional groups of the Reform Movement has collected together, if you are a Jewish professional. But if you are someone out there who is just working, there are many different ways to access data, and certainly many ways to have quiet, hopefully stress-free conversations. But it's really, really important that we're not only in it for ourselves, but that we have the ability to influence our places of employment, whether it's a synagogue, a Jewish organization, or the secular workplace, and to make sure and ensure that everyone in every position in the building is being paid equitably.
I love that. I really appreciate this ability to talk about transparency. Gabe, I know that this is something that actually really matters to you. It's something that you've stood up for before in your past. What advice do you have?
I think my advice to everybody is to make sure you're valuing yourself and your time as highly as you can. If you're going into a situation where you're thinking, you know, I'm not sure what I'm worth, or if you're undervaluing yourself, it's hard to then turn around and ask for more. That said, not everybody has that ability or that opportunity or really that privilege to be able to advocate for themselves. So for those of us who are in a position of privilege where we are able to not only advocate for ourselves, but as Mary said, affect change in our communities, I think it's really important to recognize that not everybody has that power or that ability to necessarily advocate for themselves or even the knowledge of how to negotiate compensation effectively. We need to come into those situations really open and honest and, as you said, transparent.
So I think for me, two things are really important. I think one is my statement that everyone can negotiate. You may not always get everything you want for it, but any number that's given to you is a start of a conversation. And I think that there are a lot of people who don't realize that. There are especially people who might be still struck from the recession of 2008, 2009, and struggling, you know, about what's happened post-COVID. There's a lot of fear and a lot of rushing to getting a job and being happy and thankful to get any job anywhere at any point just to make sure that you're okay. As Gabe said, remember what you're worth and remember the fact that every number that's given is really just like a start to a conversation, and that salary is only one part of a compensation package. And there are a lot of things that are open to discussion and negotiation. The second piece that I think is important to speak about is being willing to really just be, you know, I know we've talked a lot about transparency, but being willing to ask questions, you know, being willing to ask the questions, to do some research. There's a lot of information out there, especially in the Reformed Jewish community, especially if you, by the way, are going for rabbinic placement. I know that there are salary calculators that are out there, I think from 2 years ago, I think, is the most updated one. But the ability to ask questions and have a support network where people can really be in touch with you about what they're going through, whether they're going through it at the same time as you or whether they've gone through it before you, getting a second opinion can be incredible. And I like to think that Sarah would have gotten a second opinion, you know, about the offer that Abram made her when they were in Egypt. But these are all conversations that are important, whether you're talking about compensation packages, whether you're talking about negotiations, whether you're talking about, you know, what you have to offer, what they have to offer. All of these things matter in the ability to help set people up for success, both in your time and the times that are going to come after you. And all of these conversations matter. And so, Mary, for people who might want to continue the conversation or learn more, how can they best find or follow you?
Well, I would certainly love for people to reach out. And first of all, the Women's Rabbinic Network has a website, womensrabbinicnetwork.org. There you will find, I'll just point your attention to our paid family and medical leave resource. You can download it for free. It is a very complete expert resource that you can bring to your employer with a Jewish framing, with a secular framing, and to raise that topic. And we're going to continue to build that out with more educational resources around that. But many legacy organizations are using that right now, and employees, rather, are using that in negotiations. We also have a on Women in the Rabbinate. We have our Facebook group, our Instagram page home where you can visit us, and within the website to see our accountability and repair work, we have wrnresources.org. But if you also go through our main website, you can. So lots of ways. Mary Zamor at womensrabbinicnetwork.org.
Incredible. It's been such a pleasure to get to learn and kind of push back in some of our Torah portion today with you, and to get to learn from you, and just really to be in conversation with somebody who I think not only just takes such a strong stance, but really does it for everybody in and around the Jewish community. And so thank you so much, Rabbi Zamor, for joining us for our third Lech Lecha, one of our favorite portions, because that was our kickoff portion. Believe it or not, Gabe, while we're in our third season, this is our second year, which is crazy. Thank you so much, Gabe, for being here. Thank you so much to Idan and to Kate for helping edit and make sure that we always get out on time. I do want to point out that by the time that this is released, we're going to be a little over a week away from Election Day. So this is my reminder to everybody to, yes, get out the vote, which is what we did with our first Lech Lecha episode, was, you know, make sure that we wanted people just to be able to make their voices be heard. So we hope that your voices can be heard. Get out the vote. Make sure that your voice is heard in the polls. We are excited to be able to just be here on this journey for us, for you, and our conclusions coming at you soon. Stay tuned. Gabe, I'm really glad that we were able to have this conversation because realistically, as a woman in the field, and even as somebody who might be a little older going into her first rabbinic role, there are so many elements that are confusing or seem slightly out of reach. And I'll tell you, our Torah portions don't always have such great outcomes or opportunities or options for women or non-cis men.
I hear you. I think that this Torah portion in particular really highlights some pretty awful power dynamics.
Yeah, and it does seem a little bit like there's some delayed anger, there's some laughter, there's some mockery. There are issues that come with not wanting to face the problems ahead of us, which is that sometimes people are put in really unsafe positions outside of their control. I do appreciate the fact that Rabbi Zamor talked about our needing to not only think about ourselves when positioning ourselves for places of strength, but also really thinking about the people around us and making sure that as we build ourselves up, just like Sarah hoped to do through Hagar, that we're able to build those people up with us. We're able to kind of lift everyone up together.
I love this idea of, you know, lifting up each other and, you know, getting strong together. But I think it can often be hard. I think that, you know, for a lot of people, we might not even be aware of the issues around us. How do we, you know, look around and really make sure that we're being cognizant of the power dynamics in our lives?
I think it can be difficult. You know, a lot of the time there are people who have a victim mindset. There are people who have kind of a superiority complex. There are people who have an inferiority complex. And sometimes you just need to be able to have the conversation with people to maybe figure out where it is that you really stand. Maybe the best way to understand these power differentials or these abilities to, you know, fight some of the systems of power and change our behavior is to be in conversation with everyone around us. And maybe outside our social circles as well.
I think that's a really great point. I think that, you know, we talked about transparency and pay equity. And, you know, there's also this idea that Hagar, her name is literally the stranger. She is explicitly an outsider. So we do really need to look at all of these different, you know, intersections of identity when we're thinking about these power dynamics, that not only is Hagar a woman, not only is she in a lower socioeconomic class, but also of a different nation. She's a stranger. I think that it's important for us to recognize not only our privilege, but also recognize where we stand in a wide variety of different identities.
I think the ability to be in conversation with people who are like us or who are different from us allows us and enables us to really get into the nitty-gritty of what the world is asking from us. I mean, it's difficult to look at things from my Brooklyn bedroom when I'm not necessarily aware of what's happening all the time in Prospect Park across the street. I have to be able to get out, be in those areas, talk with different people, and learn about what the needs of my community are.
And you have to be honest when having those conversations. Just because Abraham went to Egypt doesn't mean that he really had a good experience. He needed to be honest, and he wasn't, and it didn't end well for him.
Well, actually, it did end well for him. Like, that's one of the challenges. He got rewarded for dishonest behavior. He also, to be fair, got kicked out a little bit, but he did get to be rich in the process. Maybe that's not the lesson we want our listeners to hear this week, but here's what I think Gabe's trying to say. I think Gabe's trying to say, if you're coming at these conversations from a place of honesty and a place of openness and a place of understanding, really there's the ability to actually take the first step on a new journey towards self-awareness, towards being able to better ourselves, towards being able to recognize a change that might need to be made. And we're all for that. We're also excited to hear about what you think those changes might be, whether they're in the podcast, in your life, or, you know, anywhere that you might be able to think of. Feel free to be in touch with us at www.drinkinganddreshing.com. Be in touch with us on our Discord channel or on our social media. We're always excited to talk with you and to be able to continue the conversations both on the air and online. And hey, maybe even in person if we ever get to meet. We are so thrilled to be here with you kicking off this third Lech Lecha and, you know, getting to celebrate 2 years of Drinking and Drashing having been completed on the air. We hope that all of you have enjoyed being on this journey with us. And for those who might be new to listening, hey, welcome. We're excited to have you with us. We promise not to put you in front of Egyptian, you know, army and say that you're a sister, unless it's something that you want. But either way, we raise our glass to you and say, L'chaim.
L'chaim.
I'm Rabbi Mary Zamor, and you have been listening to Drinking and Drashing, Torah with a Twist, wishing everyone plenty of truth, equity, and beautiful change in the world.